Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The most epic story of all is the one you can imagine with Audible. Surround yourself with out-of-the-world adventure. Land yourself a killer case that's yours to solve. And let yourself experience the drive that builds a champion. Epic stories told by your favorite Canadian voices, like Joshua Jackson, Kobe Smulders, and Sidney Crosby. With so many audiobooks, podcasts, and originals, there's more to imagine at audible.ca.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Get more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply. Visit DoorDash.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jeanette Jalil, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 28th of March, these are our main stories. Russian missiles have hit cities across Ukraine, killing civilians in their homes. The chairman of the BBC, Richard Sharp, has resigned after a row over a loan given to the then Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. An ancient stone is being moved from Scotland to London for the coronation of King Charles III. Also in this podcast, the man chosen to be the first disabled astronaut to go into space gets a taste of what it will be like to experience weightlessness.
And here we are, weightless. Absolutely amazing. This is what it feels like. Woohoo!
And Black Sabbath, the ballet. It's been a terrifying and traumatic night for many people in Ukraine after Russia launched a new wave of missile attacks. As we record this podcast, the latest update from Ukrainian officials is that at least 18 people have been killed. Most of these were in the central city of Uman, where a nine-story building collapsed after being hit. This woman in Uman spoke to reporters there.
My daughter's classmate lived on the ninth floor of the destroyed apartment block. Praise God they're alive. It's a great tragedy.
In the eastern city of Dnipro, a woman and her infant child also lost their lives. Kyiv was targeted for the first time in nearly 2 months. The authorities say Ukraine did manage to shoot down many of the incoming missiles. The attacks come as anticipation mounts that Ukrainian forces will soon launch a counter-offensive with new military equipment, including tanks supplied by Western allies. This comes after Russian forces have made little headway in their winter offensive. Jack Losh is a freelance journalist in Ukraine. He told us more about the hardest-hit city, Uman.
This is a city in central Ukraine, around 300 kilometres from the front line. Uman is not a military target. It's, in fact, a pretty quiet, sleepy town. And really, there doesn't seem any reason to bomb such a place besides an attempt to terrorize a civilian population. This is a town that I know personally. I passed through it last year, soon after the invasion, and it was actually a key stopping point for thousands of displaced families who were fleeing westwards. That gives you a sense of how relatively safe it is, or how safe it's perceived. And yet today we've seen footage of yet another devastated apartment building with rubble strewn around it, fires blazing inside, rescuers trying to extinguish these blazes and going through the rubble to save survivors and pull out the bodies. Images that unfortunately we have become all too accustomed to over the last 14 months of war. After a winter blitz by Russia on Ukrainian cities across the nation, this is yet another reminder of what Russia is willing to do and what it's capable of doing.
But there doesn't really seem to be a strategy behind it, does there? Because they've been bogged down for months now in their efforts to just retake one eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut.
Exactly. It's hard to see the logic behind such an attack. I believe around 23 missiles were launched by Russia. We're told by officials that 21 of these missiles were taken down by Ukrainian air defence. Ukrainian air defence has been working extremely hard today since the early hours of the morning, along with two attack drones that were shot down. Most of Russia's military attempts at winning the war are focused along the front line and specifically in the embattled town of Bakhmut. But again, this is a reminder that if it wishes to, Moscow can strike peaceful, quiet towns far away from the front line and devastate civilian lives in the process.
Jack Losh in Ukraine. Pope Francis has warned of the dangers of rising nationalism in Europe at the start of his three-day visit to Hungary. After landing in Budapest, he was met at the Sándor Palace by President Katalin Novak and greeted by the sounds of Hungary's army orchestra. Many in this Catholic-majority nation are delighted by the Pope's visit, including the Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, whose own anti-immigration views stand in stark contrast to the Pope's pleas for compassion for refugees. Our correspondent in Budapest, Nick Thorpe, is covering the Pope's visit and said he had a pointed message for Mr. Orbán in his speech.
He spoke, as you say, of the rise of nationalism. He spoke of he touched on many things, criticisms one could see. He spoke of the need for nations, for peoples to welcome strangers. He said this was the true Christian message to humanity. So that could be very much seen as criticism of the Prime Minister and his policies on migration and asylum seekers. But there were also other comments which were, I think, definitely will be taken by the government here as words of praise, praise for their defence of Christians who are persecuted around the world. Praise also for Hungary's family policies. So there was, in a way, it was a very interesting speech, carefully balanced, with a lot of criticism of Europe as well for failing to do more to act in a creative way to stop the war in Ukraine.
It's interesting you say that, the balance between criticism and praise, because I think a lot of people are saying that Mr. Orbán is hoping to capitalise on the Pope's visit, despite their very different views on migration and the Ukraine war.
Definitely, you know, Mr. Orbán is isolated at the moment. Hungary is isolated because of those policies, its reluctance to criticise Russia in the past, during this past year, over the war, its constant criticism or tension with President Zelensky of Ukraine over the fate of Hungarians in Ukraine. So I think, though there will have been plenty of elements in the Pope's speech here, which Mr. Orbán will be able to use, but he will have to be careful with some of the other elements because there was a lot of criticism. It was very interesting and clear for every single word clearly counted in this speech by Pope Francis here in Budapest today.
And away from the politics, how much excitement is there among Hungarians about this visit and what are we expecting in the coming days?
There is a lot of excitement, not only among Catholics. This is a predominantly Catholic country, but not as devout, say, as Poland or some other places in Eastern Europe. So I think a lot of people will be lining the streets. It's the first major papal visit since 1996. And so I think there will also be speeches. The Pope will be meeting refugees to Hungary, but he'll also be meeting young Hungarians, he'll be meeting the clergy, some of whom I think have been confused in the past by these mixed messages about peace and migration.
Nick Thorpe in Budapest. He's going to be the first disabled astronaut to go into space. And John McFall, a British Paralympian who's been recruited as the European Space Agency's first para-astronaut, has had a taste of what it'll be like in orbit, experiencing zero gravity for the first time on a simulated parabolic flight. Mr. McFall, who has a prosthetic leg, has been testing how easy it is for people with a physical disability to live and work in space. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, was there with him.
3, 2, 1. The parabolic flight works by climbing steeply, then nosediving back down. In between, you experience moments of weightlessness.
Get ready, here we go.
John gently rises off the floor, floating towards the ceiling of the plane.
And here we are, weightless. Absolutely amazing. This is what it feels like. Woohoo!
We're tumbling around. Tiny movements catapult you across the cabin.
Amazing!
A very happy-sounding John McFall, and he's been speaking to my colleague, Sean Farrington, about the project.
more and more people are going to be wanting to go to space in the decades and centuries to come. So this will be sort of the first step, a stepping stone into trying to understand a little bit more about how training for and living and working in space might impact someone with a physical disability. So, you know, looking at how having an amputation in my specific case will affect my ability to train, to go up in space, the safety of actually going up in a rocket, but also how does having an amputation like mine and other physical disabilities affect the way that you live and work in space.
Could you explain your situation and your amputation and the what you learnt from the training that you've been in so far?
So I'm an above-knee amputee on the right side of my lower leg, and what I learnt when we did this parabolic flight recently was that you probably don't need complex prosthetics. You know, on Earth, I use day-to-day a complex prosthesis that has microprocessors and gyroscopes in the knee and everything like that. It's a very advanced knee. But actually, in the environment of microgravity, you probably don't need something like that. And so starting to get a feel for how you might move around the cabin or the ISS in weightlessness, I had an opportunity to sort of experience that and work out how my prosthesis or wearing a prosthesis might work or might affect me.
You're a British Paralympian medal winner, and now you're the European Space Agency's first para-astronaut. How on earth did you get on this journey?
I work as an orthopaedic surgeon, and I was working with some colleagues, and a friend of mine sent me a message saying, John, they're looking for Paralympians to go to space. So anyway, I looked up the announcement that ESA had made that they were looking to do this feasibility project, and I looked at the person's specification, and I thought, wow, this sounds really, really interesting. And I looked at what it would involve and what they were looking for, and I thought, yeah, I can do that.
Paralympian and para-astronaut John McFall. When you think of ballet, you probably don't think of this. But in what's being billed as the world's first heavy metal dance experience, rehearsals are now underway for Black Sabbath the Ballet. The band, who hail from Birmingham in central England, have teamed up with the Birmingham Royal Ballet to create a show set to their music, where dancers will both headbang and pirouette to their music. Tickets have now sold out, snapped up by Black Sabbath fans, many of whom have never been to a ballet before. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson has been to see the rehearsals.
Pirouetting to Paranoid. This is Black Sabbath the Ballet in their hometown of Birmingham. The heavy metal pioneers were never exactly known for their pas-de-deux, with Ozzy Osbourne famous for biting bats, not ballet. But the old-time dance great Carlos Acosta, who's now based in Brum, had an idea.
One of the things that I wanted to do when I joined Birmingham Royal Ballet is to bring awareness of the treasure that this city had given to the world, and Black Sabbath is a perfect fit. It is a subject that it opens curiosity, because we come from the ballet world and then the heavy metal world. What's going to be the negotiation? What will be the product at the end? And that excites me.
The ballet, which will premiere in September, is described as a metal symphony over three acts. And crucially, Carlos persuaded Sabbath's guitarist, Tony Iommi, to give the show his blessing.
Black Sabbath the Ballet, why?
Why not?
How much did you know about ballet beforehand?
Not a dot. No, I didn't. I've never been to a ballet. Evil mind of plus destruction!
How involved is Ozzy?
Ozzy's not really involved. Well, he's in the States anyway, and I'm the only one here.
How is he at the moment?
He's okay. I heard from him a couple of days ago. He's doing well. I think he's going to have another operation. But he's dying to get back here. He really wants to come back to England.
And see the ballet?
Yes, he might well be. If he's back in time, he'll be here, yeah.
The Birmingham run has already sold out, but there are hopes that the show will travel around the world. Yes, Black Sabbath back on tour, ballet style.
I'm sure there'll be a lot of interest for that one. That was Colin Patterson reporting. Coming up on the podcast, from poet and pacifist to World War II bomber, we look at the inner lives of men at war.
I thought that was just fascinating that a man could have that complexity, could go from pacifism to being the person who decides who lives and dies on the ground, essentially civilians as well.
In 2008, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martina Vik Magnusson was killed in an apartment near Mayfair. Hours after her death, the only suspect in the case fled the UK to Yemen. He's never been questioned by the police. I'm Noelle El-Makhafi, and I made a promise to Martina's family 15 years ago to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair. Part of the documentary. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. After a long simmering row that has raised concerns about the BBC's independence and impartiality, the chairman of the BBC, Richard Sharp, has resigned after a report found he failed to properly disclose his involvement in facilitating a loan of nearly $1 million for the then British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Although the BBC is a public broadcaster, the chairman is appointed by the government. The report found that Mr. Sharp had breached the government's code for public appointments. He said he'd made an inadvertent error. The British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, was asked why Richard Sharp hadn't been sacked earlier.
This is about doing things properly and professionally. And when concerns are raised, it's right that there is a proper process, an independent process, that we don't prejudge. We allow it to carry on, establish the facts of what happened, reach a conclusion. That's happened. Richard Sharp has resigned. But it's right that we do these things properly and professionally. I think most people will think that's the right thing to do.
Our political correspondent, Rob Watson, told us more about Mr. Sharp's resignation.
This report has basically sort of said, look, it's not so much what he did, but the fact that he didn't tell everybody who was involved in that process of appointing him. And why does that matter? Well, you know, for the obvious reason that you'd probably want to know if the guy who's going to be chairman of the BBC had any involvement, no matter how kosher the involvement, in facilitating a loan for the Prime Minister.
And we have to stress, it wasn't Mr. Sharp who made this loan, but he did play a role in introducing the person who then went on to make the loan to Boris Johnson.
Yes, and in a sentence, he says, and I don't think this inquiry or the MPs have particularly disputed that, it's not that he did anything wrong, it's just that he didn't tell them about it.
And this has been brewing for quite a long time. Some people are saying this has taken an awfully long time to come to this point. Why so long?
It's taken this long because I think Mr. Sharp was very keen to stay on. I mean, he really likes being chairman of the BBC. It's something that you know, he says he takes seriously. It's a very exciting role in the media world. And I think because also he wanted to wait to see if this report came out and whether he could survive it. And he's clearly taken the view that he couldn't.
And how embarrassing is this for the government and for the BBC?
It's not great for the government and it's not great for the BBC. Let's start with the BBC first. I mean, the problem is that you're going to have lots of people in this country and around the world thinking, hang on a minute, the BBC is headed by a Conservative, right? I mean, he's given lots of money to the Conservative Party. He was very friendly with Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak. I mean, it's not the case. The chairman's role, he's not like the editor-in-chief. He's not telling you and I what to broadcast at this moment. He doesn't choose the stories. But there is the danger that that is the perception. The problem for the government is that, you know, this was someone that they appointed to the role and that it's now opened them up to accusations from the opposition of, my goodness, yet more senior Conservatives giving their mates jobs in places like the BBC. What on earth is going on? We're looking like a banana republic.
Rob Watson. An ancient stone which has been used for centuries as part of the ceremony to crown Britain's monarchs has officially left Scotland ahead of next week's coronation. The Stone of Destiny, which will be placed under the 700-year-old coronation chair at Westminster Abbey, had a typically Scottish send-off from Edinburgh Castle. Our Scotland correspondent, Lorna Gordon, told us more about the stone and its significance.
to look at it, it's very unassuming. It's a slab of light-coloured sandstone, weighs about 125 kilograms. It's called the Stone of Destiny or the Stone of Scone. So not much to look at, but it is a sacred historic symbol of Scotland's monarchy and nationhood. That is how it is perceived by many. And its move south was amid very tight security and secrecy. It took a lot of negotiation to get in and film it, and no one knows exactly what time it was moved from its home at Edinburgh Castle South. We don't know what route it was taken on or when exactly it will arrive at Westminster Abbey. The reason for that was the fear that protesters might try to interfere or disrupt its first outing south of the border since it was returned to Scotland after 700 years.
And it was stolen some years ago as well. Why is its return to London so controversial?
Well, there is all this symbolism and history surrounding the stone. It was taken by England's King Edward I, seized by him in 1296 during the Wars of Independence. It was incorporated into the coronation chair then, and then it was used in subsequent coronations of English and then British monarchs since 1399. As you say, in 1950, Christmas Day 1950, four Scottish students seized the stone from its home at Westminster Abbey because they wanted to make a statement about Scottish independence. Months later, it was discovered 500 miles away in Arbroath Abbey, which is a very symbolic place in Scotland where there was an assertion of Scottish nationhood in the declaration of in the form of the Declaration of Arbroath. It was then taken back to Westminster Abbey and then in 1996 permanently returned to Scotland on condition that it could be lent temporarily back to Westminster Abbey for any future coronation. So it was used in the coronation of Queen Elizabeth, and next weekend it will be used in the coronation of King Charles III.
Lorna Gordon. Fighting is still raging in the Sudanese capital Khartoum and the Darfur region, despite the rival military factions agreeing to extend their fragile ceasefire. This comes as foreign countries are still scrambling to evacuate their citizens. Turkey's defence ministry reported that one of the planes it had sent out to rescue people was fired at as it was coming into land at an airbase near Khartoum. No one was injured and the plane landed safely. The power struggle between the army and the rival paramilitary force, the Rapid Support Forces, has killed hundreds in the past 2 weeks. Our reporter, Nick Garnett, is at Larnaca International Airport in Cyprus, where many evacuation flights from Sudan are landing.
We're hearing that a Turkish evacuation plane was coming in to land at the airfield 20 kilometres north of Khartoum, which has been used by both the Germans for the last 2 weeks and the United Kingdom forces as well, that have been using it to evacuate their personnel and the people with British passports, that a Turkish plane going in to use the same airstrip was fired at. It did manage to land safely, and I'm reading that the fuel system may have been damaged as a result of that. Now, the Sudanese army are blaming the paramilitaries for the shooting. Now, at the same time, the army has also been doing its own offensive against RSF positions in Khartoum, firing at those overnight. We've heard a lot of reports that the firing has been intense in some areas. Now, what the authorities and the British government are very keen about is to make sure that any outbreaks of violence are far away from that airfield, because that is the preferred place that they're asking people to go to evacuate them. If this is true, that a Turkish plane on the way in at a fairly low altitude has been attacked, well, it raises all sorts of questions about the safety of those planes and the safety of the operations that's going on. Now, the British government has said that the 72 hours of the new ceasefire will mean they can get 500 people out every day. That's in total 1,500, on top of nearly 1,000 that are already out, which would account for all the people that the government knows wants to leave the country. There are around 4,000 nationals from Britain who are living in Sudan, and 2,000 have said that they wanted to leave. So if things go well and the flights continue at the rate that they have been doing, then the numbers should add up, and the number of people who want to leave should equate to that. The problem is, if you take out the escape route through the airfield, then there are very, very limited options available. One of them is going into Egypt, another one is going to Port Sudan, 800 kilometres away, and trying to get out by ferry.
Nick Garnett. Now, here in the UK, when people hark back to the Second World War, they often talk about the bravery of the few. The words used by Winston Churchill to pay tribute to how Britain's fighter pilots managed to fend off the superior military might of the German Air Force. A new book called Men at War, Loving, Lusting, Fighting, Remembering, paints a more complex and nuanced picture of some of the men who served. My colleague, Michelle Hussein, has been speaking to its author, Luke Turner.
And I wanted to explore the men behind the machines and see them in a more complex way, really. There's that famous Churchill speech, which I really love, where he talks about all he has to give is blood, toil, tears and sweat. And I thought those are kind of like martial energies, a real masculine sense to them. But I wanted to look at them as energies of desire as well, because I think that's something we lose in how we perceive the men of the Second World War.
One of the characters you put in the book is called Bertram War.
Mm, yes, exactly.
Tell us about him.
Well, the book has a lot of LGBT plus characters because I think they're often written out of war history. But I didn't want those men to just be there on their own. I wanted to see them as part of wider masculinity. And Bertram War I found fascinating because of his complex attitude to the Second World War. He was a Canadian, a poet. He stowed away in a liner and came to London in 1938. And he was a pacifist and a socialist. And he writes very eloquently about his views on pacifism and was very committed to that belief, but ended up becoming bomb aimer in a Halifax bomber of 158 Squadron. And I thought that was just fascinating that a man could have that complexity, could go from pacifism to deciding, being the person who decides who lives and dies on the ground, essentially civilians as well.
Well, also with us from the BBC's Cambridge studios, Tony Frost, who's the nephew of Bertram War. Morning, Tony.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
And I know you subsequently, through your connection with Bertram, got involved in the 158 Squadron Association. That was the squadron he was part of. So what did you know about your uncle growing up?
Very little, really. I knew that he was a bomb aimer and was killed in the war, and that he was a poet, and he had a book out. But the trauma in the family of it, because there were two brothers, they were both killed within 6 months of each other. And even all those years later, in the 70s, when I was growing up, it was almost taboo to talk about them, because the family were just so upset about it still all those years later. So I didn't really know that much about him until I started research when I retired and started doing research into the family tree, and I got all his letters from my aunt, and then I contacted 158 Squadron and got very involved with the whole thing there. So my knowledge of him has come secondary.
And Luke, was this what you used as well, the writings, including the poems?
Yeah, 158 Squadron is fascinating because it's not like the Dam Busters or anything like that. It's not a glamour squadron of the Second World War that's seen as iconic today or what have you. It was a very ordinary squadron, yet it has this literary legacy that's astonishing. And I discovered this online. The website that Tony runs is fantastic. And there's memoirists, there's writers of religious tracts.
Was that
there's
just
historians.
A coincidence that they happened to be in that squadron?
I mean, a lot of squadrons did have this literary legacy, some probably just because the archives aren't so good. Aren't as well catalogued, but I do think it's interesting the breadth of the literary legacy of the 158 Squadron people. And I got in touch with Tony and Kevin Bryant, who's the chairman, and Chuck, and they were all so helpful in my research. And I actually went up to RAF Lissett, where there's still remains of the airfield and a very moving and powerful memorial up there.
What conclusion did you come to about how he moved from being a pacifist to being on board planes that were part of Bomber Command?
It's very, as Luke says, he's a very complicated character because he didn't lose his pacifistic ideas all through the war, but he came to believe that he just couldn't abandon the people in this struggle. I mean, in one letter he says he changed his mind about going home to Canada. He says, I've been here for some time and it'd be unfair to leave just now when I can be of some help. This was during the Blitz. So he tried to get in as an ambulance driver or on an ambulance crew, but they wouldn't have him. So then he ended up in the RAF.
Luke, how much do you deal with fear? Because that's one of... We imagine that all these men who did this were very brave and they were brave all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can be afraid and brave at the same time. And I do think that's part of the complexity of the emotions. There was a survey I think the army did in the Second World War to find out sort of the attitude towards fighting. And only 7% of men were sort of really up for, were kind of wanting to get stuck in. And the rest, everyone else had a more ambiguous relationship with it. And some of the accounts from particularly the Bomber Command, which was the most dangerous part of the British forces in the war, you were very unlikely to come home. You were very unlikely to survive. The fear is written about very, very eloquently and very powerfully.
Luke Turner, author of Men at War, Loving, Lusting, Fighting, Remembering 1939 to 1945. And Michelle Hussein was also talking to Tony Frost, the nephew of one of the men who died in the Second World War. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Ablakwa. The producer was Vanessa Heaney. The editor, as always, is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Fifteen years ago, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair.
Den norske studenten Martine Vik Magnussen.
23-year-old Martine Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
Police investigating the murder of a Norwegian socialite in central London.
Her body was found in the building where the only suspect was living, Farouk Abdelhak, the son of one of the Middle East's richest and most powerful men. Before being questioned, Farouk fled from the UK to Yemen, where he's been ever since. I'm Noelle El-Makhafi. I made a promise to Martina's family over a decade ago to find out what happened and do what no journalist nor the police have been able to do until now. Find Farouk. Murder in Mayfair. Listen to the whole story now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In 2012, a new charity bursts onto the scene. It's called Believe in Magic, and it grants wishes to seriously ill children. It has the support of the biggest boy band in the world, One Direction. It's run by an inspirational 16-year-old girl called Megan Bari, who herself is battling a brain tumour.
I've been in and out of hospital and seen so many other very poorly children.
But when questions arise about her story, they reveal she could be facing another very different danger.
What is this girl going through?
It wasn't supposed to end like this.
Listen to Believe in Magic with me, Jamie Bartlett.
Just imagine if you could quiet the noise and journey to deep sleep. Relax, I got you. I'm Shamir Anderson. Escape with me to soothing soundscapes around the globe. We'll wait out a storm on the Ethiopian islands and take in the waves on a secluded Brazilian beach. Sleep sound with me, Shamir Anderson, an Audible original. Available now on audible.ca.